the system. So yes, there's need to retool the system. There's need to have functional education, the type of education that makes people have agency to understand that certain decisions are taken on their own without having to rely on, you know, the groupthink and, you know, the exploitation of their religion or their culture or their current economic situation. That is what the terrorists, you know, exploit most of the time. So for me, education is a veritable tool to restructure the mindset, to reset the mindset of people, you know, in the affected regions. When you have the right kind of education, the right type of exposure and intellection, you will not be railroaded into the antics of terrorists and insurgents, as the case may be.
Thanks, Mr. Ahmad, for that. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on how the so-called U.S. war on terror has actually led to a 100,000% increase of terrorism in Africa over the last two decades.
U.S. increased terrorism in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. This week we are focusing on an unprecedented upsurge of terrorism in Africa amid the presence of U.S. troops across the continent.
Bassoma Bazi, Minister of State of Burkina Faso, in an address to the UN General Assembly last year, stressed that his country, Mali and Niger, are dealing with a war imposed on them by imperialism under the pretext of terrorism.
Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso are dealing with a war that was imposed upon them by imperialism under the pretext of terrorists. And these are sowing terror and destruction, despite the UN Charter with its principles of equality, justice on one hand, and on the other hand, international law, which has been often cited here at the UN. There is a massive chasm between in the treatment of these different issues.
Professor Abdul Wahab, what's your take on this statement by the minister from Burkina Faso, a country currently at the forefront of battling imperialism?
But that statement, I agree with him. You know, the Western imperialists are undermining the security of African nations. They are the one who, in fact, assisting and supporting terrorism in Burkina Faso. When the military seizes the power, then they can easily contain all those, you know, militias who get a support from the Western imperialists, so that they can easily loot the African resources. So the question is, why, when the military came to power, Burkina Faso, Niger, Guinea, and Mali are more safe today than 2 years, 3 years ago? Because 2 or 3 years ago, all those guys who are, you know, terror organizations, be it what they call Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram, are getting a support for the Western imperialists so that they can create a tension, conflict, you know, among the African societies. Africans, they must come together and defend themselves against the Western imperialists. The African society, they come together and fight against the terror groups who are getting support from the Western world. That's the only thing the African society, they can survive. Otherwise, the neocolonialism is real, and they continue to root Africa. Because today, French, for instance, if French stop looting Africa, automatically French will become a third world country, as we speak right now. They will become a third world country. So in order to France become a strong nation, in order to be a superpower, they have to lead Africa. All Western cities or all Western countries, they build the blood of African society.
Now, apart from poverty, ignorance has been cited as a major reason that terrorist groups find recruiting grounds in Africa. Now, Professor Abdul Wahab Sheikh, do you think the root cause of violent extremism and terrorism in Africa can be addressed through proper education and training?
No question about that. Both education and training can, can improve the livelihood of the African society, can improve the security and safety of the African continent. Mainly other factors, apart from the terrorism and violent terrorism, other factors which contribute the instability of Africa, including among others, that's a political corruption, economic inequality, social fractures, and local grievances also contribute to the terrorism in Africa. So all those factors together, they in fact contribute the safety and security of African society, apart from all those facts above are part and parcel of the insecurity in Africa. And the sooner they address the issue of the political corruption, the issue of the economic inequality, the issue of the social fractures, and also addressing the local grievances can easily improve the security of the African continent.
For decades, Africa has been teaming with foreign military personnel, with more than a dozen countries known to have deployments and bases on the continent. The US and its allies, such as France, the UK, Germany, Italy, and Belgium, have military presence on the continent. Despite this presence, insecurity is rampant across the continent.
A professor in Mali, speaking before French troops were ejected from the country, said that ever since they trusted France, a U.S. ally, to assist in combating terrorism, the situation in the country worsened.
I'd be so happy like at a party if France quit Mali today. Really, ever since we trusted them with our security, everything has become worse.
Clearly, these U.S.-led imperialist forces are the source of instability in Africa. Mr. Ahmad, what's your opinion on this?
Okay, so this is what I think of it. I always say that African problems require African solutions. Why are the foreign forces on the African soil present? Africans will make, gestures to them seeking for help and assistance. But you see, internally, what Africans should do is to close ranks, is to look for alternative approach to defeating these monsters, because you cannot have investment, you cannot have hospitality, you cannot have your businesses and enterprise running smoothly if you have a miasma of insecurity cutting across the region. So beyond blaming and finger pointing at the US, we must internalize our solution. We must be able to say that within ourselves we have identified the problem, and then we have homegrown solutions to fix the problem. Yes, it is easy to say the American forces should go, the American assistance, we do not need it, Western interference should go. However, we must find homegrown solutions, within ourselves, close ranks, and ensure that we defeat, the rising insecurity on the continent.
There is no doubt that U.S. forces are up to no good in Africa, and are in fact there to take care of Washington's illegitimate economic and geopolitical interests. Now, many people in Africa are demanding that U.S. troops and other imperialist forces withdraw, as we have seen, and let African countries take care of their own security with the assistance of non-imperialist powers. Professor Abdul Wahab, you have the last word. What's your take on this?
The U.S. presence in Africa is not a good sign. It's not welcome at all in the continent. The sooner they depart from the continent, the better. For the last quarter century, the U.S. intervention in Africa is not good. A very good example in Libya, when they intervened in Libya, 2011, Libya was a stable state. Libya has functioning institutions. Libya has a better life than today. But as we speak right now, where is Libya? Libya is gone. Again, the intervention of the Sahel state is specifically the French intervention, and together with American intervention in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, together with and Guinea, it's not good. That's why the African society, they start, you know, organizing themselves. They start, you know, against the Western interventions in Africa. They start, they're realizing the military presence in USA, in Africa, is not adding up. It's not, you know, assisting the security and safety of the African nations. But it's a part and parcel of African problems. So the sooner they left Africa, the better. The sooner they depart Africa, the better. The sooner, in fact, you know, stop that kind of approach, which is undermining the safety and security of the continent, is better. They must come up a new approach so that they can easily, you know, gain the hearts and minds of African society. Otherwise, the multipolar system is real. And I don't think so now, right now, you know, U.S. intervention in Africa is highly welcome.
Well, there you have it. There is no doubt that U.S. military presence in Africa is a major factor in the upsurge of terrorism across the continent. And the sooner the U.S. forces leave Africa, the better. I'd like to thank our guest today, Professor Abdulwahab Sheikh Abdul Samad, the Chief Executive Officer of Afro-Asia Institute for Strategic Studies based in Nairobi, and Abdul Latif Ahmad, a digital news editor. Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. From Mubarak, Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
Palestinians in Rafah ask the world to stop the Zionist regime's invasion. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "A displaced Palestinian in Rafah told the Palestine Chronicle, 'Stop the killing, stop the occupation's crimes, and restore our lives.' The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israeli occupation forces will invade the city of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, despite international calls to abandon the plans. World leaders and human rights groups have repeatedly warned against a catastrophic ground offensive in the overcrowded city, where an estimated 1.5 million displaced Palestinians have been pushed to escape horrific Israeli regime bombardment across the Gaza Strip. The Palestine Chronicle spoke to displaced Palestinians who are currently sheltered in makeshift refugee camps in southern city. Khawar al-Awja told the Palestine Chronicle, "Every day we hear statements from occupation leaders about imminent invasion of the city of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip." He added, "Moreover, the occupation links the invasion of Rafah to the completion of the invasion of Khan Yunis city. These statements create fear and terror for more than 1.5 million Palestinians who have been displaced to the tents of Rafah over 80 days ago." Al-Awja explained that all the displaced Palestinians in Rafah left their homes in the north, in Gaza City and in the central regions to flee from the Zionist regime's airstrikes. He said, "The occupation declared Rafah a safe area and asked us to evacuate to it. That didn't turn out to be the case at all. We have been living in these tents in Rafah for over 80 days now, without water or food. Rainwater flooded the tents several times, and our children were exposed to cold weather," Al-Awja continued. "Despite all of this, we chose to stay in the tents to preserve our lives and the lives of our children. Now, the occupation has been threatening us for days, claiming that they will invade Rafah." He added, "But we will stay in Rafah, and we will not leave the city except to return to our homes. We are tired of war and bombardment, and we are looking for security, but we cannot find it anywhere in the Gaza Strip." Samahar Al-Ghan, another Palestinian currently displaced in Rafah, told the Palestine Chronicle, "Everyone knows that the occupation is working to displace the people of the Gaza Strip to Sinai, and this is what the occupation leadership announced from the early days of the war. The occupation pushed us to migrate towards the southern Gaza Strip, then to the Egyptian border. Now it threatens to invade Rafah to push people to migrate to Sinai. But people want to return to their homes. They do not want to leave Gaza," she added. Al-Ghan recalled the journey she and her family undertook some weeks ago. She said, "We fled from the north to Rafah City, but we will not flee from Gaza, and we will not migrate from Gaza. Every moment, we dream of returning to our homes. We will never leave Gaza. We were born in Gaza, and we choose to die in it rather than migrate from it." Commenting on the repeated threats by the occupation to invade Rafah, Al-Ghan told the Palestine Chronicle that she expects the world to translate words into action. She said, "We want real movements to stop the war and ensure a safe return to our homes. We want a strong international interventions to stop the occupation's crimes, end this war, work on rebuilding Gaza, and ensuring a decent life for the besieged residents of the Gaza Strip."
Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit, but behind this resounding success lies a dark secret: toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither surrounding residents nor the company's employees.
Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples in confidential documents.
Up in there, keep an eye, get out of the head.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-Block, this is where all the medical tests and the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh man, about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability, an industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common: a culture of secrecy.
They're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry.
Everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, it was secure.
Are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency, cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey man, what can I say? There's no way in the world. If they would have informed us back then, that we would participate. No. No, no, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't invite it now.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long people were coming
in? Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This material is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found it in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow is acting in its own interests, so Dow is trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. The land is very fertile, and it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore and they could build forts and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
No. We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007, when tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency. The levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
My oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have 5 kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's, this is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, 3 times the U.S. average.
We had been married 46 years when he died. And would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.
The American Environmental Agency has finally forced Dow to clean the river. But the process has only just begun. It could take decades and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. However, no date is set for decontaminating neighboring yards like Alice Buchelter's. Dow refused all our requests for an interview. The multinational merely sent us an email stating that We seek science-based solutions that protect human health while also contributing to the well-being of the local community. On the other side of the world, another contamination is wreaking havoc. As a result of one of the worst industrial catastrophes in history, thousands of children have been affected. But Dow has never dealt with it. It happened in India, in Bhopal. In 1984, the local chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people and releasing tons of toxic products. At the time, the factory belonged to Union Carbide, a pesticide giant that Dow would buy up in 2001. The site of the Bhopal explosion is still saturated with chemical pollution. Over the years, these products have spread into the city's groundwater systems. For 15 years, the inhabitants have demanded a full decontamination. In vain, Dow refuses to act. The decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Shuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
There's so many chemicals still remaining in this quality control lab. Very few bottles are now at present. But after the disaster, this quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums, and after 32 years, still they are lying.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there is no proper care of these premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
The whole area is highly contaminated. They are dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Schwan shows us where the pesticides were made. Beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground. The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells. Like in Shakya's family home, they've lived in this house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter, 2 times the standard level of toxicity. The problem is, even in boiled water, mercury is still carcinogenic. In other areas of Bhopal, it's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Preetnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rashna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit. Due to her disabilities, Rashna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's jobless crisis is worse than previously thought, as new estimates show more than 400,000 extra people have dropped out of the labour market. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research warned businesses have become frustrated with trying to hire British workers and are increasingly looking abroad to fill vacancies. The number of firms registering to become sponsors to hire abroad has doubled in the past 2 years as hundreds of thousands of Britons abandon work. More than 9 million people of working age have dropped out of the jobs market. The economically inactive population has increased by 884,000 since before the pandemic. Wages increase has not persuaded enough of them to take one of the more than 900,000 vacancies on offer. Max Mosley, economist at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, said, "Instead, employers have been forced to look overseas for the vital staff they need." He added, "International workers are basically propping up the labour market in many ways. It is very challenging for employers, the kind of tools they have at their disposal to raise wages to try to compete, does not work anymore." More than 5 million people are now on out-of-work benefits, up from 3.5 million back in 2015. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, has found 2.8 million people who say they are neither in work nor looking for a job because of long-term sickness. According to the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, claimants are typically spending longer on benefits rather than snapping up the jobs on offer, despite the 6.5% increase in average pay in the year to November. Office figures show the number of new work visas offered last year jumped to 169,000, up 50% on the pre-COVID levels. The number of businesses registered to sponsor visas has more than doubled since 2021 to 76,310 as bosses struggle to find workers among those already in the United Kingdom. Max Mosley said, "That is why you might see them look towards international workers. Previously, only around 30,000 companies had been registered." Max Mosley said the sudden jump in businesses registering came right at the point in the supply of domestic workers got really tight. So over the pandemic in 2021, reflecting firms potentially becoming frustrated. It comes after David Miles, an executive member of the Office for Budget Responsibility, said the government must not rely on immigration to boost the economy and reduce business debts. He warned that migration is not a solution to the country's long-term financial problems, advising Prime Minister Rishi Sunak that slashing the benefits bill and getting more people into work instead would be unambiguously beneficial for the economy. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, net migration into the United Kingdom hit 672,000 in the 12 months to June of 2023, with the population expected to hit 70 million by the end of 2026. In an effort to reduce the flow of migrants, the British government is raising the salary threshold for skilled workers moving to the United Kingdom. The baseline minimum salary for sponsoring a visa is rising from £26,200 to £38,700 in April, though there are exemptions for health and care workers and teachers. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, is under pressure to cut taxes to make work more attractive. James Reid, chief executive of the recruiter Reid Jobs, said the Chancellor should unfreeze income tax thresholds to make work pay and get people back into the labour force. James Reid added, "There are a lot of reasons why someone who wasn't working might think of returning to work at the moment, and making work pay is a really important part of that." The British newspaper The Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Income tax thresholds are normally raised in the United Kingdom in line with inflation, but the bans have been frozen since April of 2022. This was first announced by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer in 2021, and then was extended by Jeremy Hunt until 2028. Soaring pay amid the cost of living crisis means more people are getting pulled into higher tax bans in a stealth tax known as fiscal drag. James Reid, chief executive of the recruiter Reid Jobs, said, "We have been through a period of quite severe inflation. The people who are caught in those thresholds now are quite different to what was originally planned." James Reid added, "The more people are working who could be made free of income tax, the better, because it encourages work. That has been going in the opposite direction." According to the Office for Budget Responsibility, by 2029, an extra 4 million people will be paying income tax compared to in 2023. A further 3 million people will have moved into the higher rate tax band. James Reid said, "Jeremy Hunt's national insurance cut, which kicked in January, has helped to increase people's take-home pay, but the Chancellor should go further and readjust the tax bands to account for inflation." He said, "Anything that can give people some more of their hard-earned cash would be welcomed, and the thresholds are a good place to start." Britain's jobless crisis is worse than previously thought, as new estimates show that more than 400,000 extra people have dropped out of the labour market. According to the Office for National Statistics, there are now 9.25 million people aged between 16 and 64 who are neither in work nor looking for work, meaning they're officially classed as economically inactive. Officials have revised the figures upwards because the adult population is almost 750,000 bigger than previously expected, fueled by greater levels of immigration. The bulk of this 750,000 is made up of people who are not working nor looking for work, as the figure shows that 172,000 are employed, 30,000 are unemployed, and 414,000 are inactive. A Treasury spokesman said, after borrowing £400 billion to protect lives and livelihoods throughout the pandemic and energy shock because of the Russia-Ukraine war, we had to take some difficult decisions to help pay it back. However, with inflation more than halved and because of the progress we have made, we have cut taxes for hard-working people, leaving the average employee £450 a year. And our tax burden remains lower than any major European economy. The Department for Work and Pensions spokesman said, we are clear that migration is not the long-term solution to growing Britain's economy. The spokesman claimed, our welfare reforms are expected to reduce the number of people who would otherwise have been placed on the higher tier of health benefits by 370,000. And our Back to Work plan will help over 1 million people start and stay in work.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, supervising and governmental organizations must prevent corruption from being conceived and fight its spread with sincerity and sensitivity. This fight needs faithful men ready for jihad, who are dignified and have pure financial records and bright hearts. This fight is an effective part of an all-around effort that the Islamic Republic must put into established justice. Justice has been among the primary ideals pursued by all prophets, and in the Islamic Republic, it has equal status and value. This is a sacred word for all times and in all lands and would not be completely established unless under the governance of Imam Mahdi. May our spirits be sacrificed for him. However, it is relatively always and everywhere possible, and it is a duty to be carried out by anyone, especially the rulers and the powerful. The Islamic Republic has taken major steps in this way, examples of which have been briefly mentioned above. Of course, more works need to be done to explain and describe the efforts made in this regard, and the conspiracy by the enemies of the revolution aimed at twisting the reality, or at least remaining silent and concealing the truth, must be nullified.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Thank you.
Regardless, I am clearly telling the beloved young people that the future of the country awaits, that what has been done until now stands at a huge distance from what must have been done. In the Islamic Republic, the officials' hearts must constantly beat for eliminating the deprivations, and they must be seriously fearful of deep class struggles. In the Islamic Republic, not only seeking wealth is not a crime, it is actually encouraged. However, discrimination in the distribution of public resources and granting special privileges and tolerating economic cheaters, all of which result in injustice, are strictly forbidden. Moreover, ignoring classes in need of support is never acceptable.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Thursday, a demonstration was staged in Rome's Parliament Square in protest against the arrest of Anan Yaish, a 37-year-old Palestinian citizen from Tulkarm in the West Bank. Anan was arrested without charge or justifiable cause by the Italian police in the central Italy mountain city of L'Aquila on January 29 on an extradition request by the Israeli government, which Italy's Justice Ministry acquiesced straight away. A month later, Anan, who holds a valid residence permit in Italy since 2017, is still detained in a prison wing housing only terrorists in the city of Terni.
Anan's detention is similar to Israel's administrative detention, when a person is kept in prison without trial, without having committed an offense. Israel even wants to intimidate the Palestinians who live abroad.
Israel believes Anan has committed one and only very serious offense. He has not given up the fight. That's why they are behind him. Italy is surveillance subservient as usual with Israel. Our authorities have arrested an innocent man who is just a member of the Palestinian resistance.
During the demonstration, activists strongly condemned Italy's government for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
We know full well how heavy Israel's influence is on the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni wanted to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations. We have seen her going hand in hand.